Series Introduction and Colossians 1:1 through 1:2. The first talk in a series on Colossians was presented by Ron Julian on July 4, 1999 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1999. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Well, I'm going to be teaching for a while. I'm starting a new series in the book of Colossians. I'm excited to be doing this. I actually don't have the opportunity all that often anymore to launch into a new study of a book, and I just decided that's what I wanted to do, so that's what you're going to be doing with me. I just plan to go through it verse by verse and explain to you as best I can what I think is going on. Today, we're really just going to get started. We're hardly going to dip into the book at all. I think we'll get as far as talking about the first two verses where Paul says hi. But I want to take a little bit of time and explain the background a bit, talk a little bit about where in the scheme of things this letter fits in. The first two verses are Paul's greeting, where he says, "Paul, an apostle of Jesus Christ by the will of God, and brother Timothy, to the saints and faithful brethren in Christ who are in Colossae, grace to you and peace from God our Father." When you come to a salutation like this, the greetings to the letters, obviously there is a formula to what Paul is following. It seems to be the formula that was common in Greek letter writing at the time. You say who it's from, you say who it's to, greetings. So as opposed to our form of a letter where we say, dear person that the letter is to, and then you say what you're going to say, and at the end you put your name. In their form, put your name first, then you say who it's to, and then you say hi. And Paul follows that form in his letters. I don't think we should think of it exactly as formulaic, though. I think of our letter writing structure as being formulaic. We start out by saying, dear somebody, and we end by saying, sincerely, you know, Joe, but when somebody reads my sincerely Ron Julian at the end of the letter, they don't think, that's what I really like about this letter, it's so sincere. I mean, it's not that kind of thing. It's just a form. It really doesn't mean that much. When you say dear, I mean, dear came from, you know, it's an expression of, you are a person who is dear to me. But we don't mean that. I mean, we say dear guy who collects the bills at the place I'm sending this to. I mean, you know, it doesn't really have anything to do with our perspective on life. It's just a form that we've adopted. I think, though, for Paul, he's taken the structure and it means more to him than that. What I see in each of his salutations, the beginnings to his letters to people, that he does take the opportunity to take this structure from to greetings to basically say, first of all, this is from Paul, but I want to tell you something about who I consider myself to be. How should you think about me, this person who's writing this letter to you? And then in the part where he says who it's to, he usually says something about how he considers them, who he considers them to be, and in particular talking about their status as people of God, people who belong to God, believers, and so on. And then in his greetings, he doesn't just say hi. He's taken the hi part, and he always fills it with some sort of an expression of what he wants for the people, what he sees as his desire for God to do for them. So it is a formula, And he is following a formula, but I don't think we can just ignore it and say it doesn't mean anything. I think in each case, it does mean something. He's actually saying something. In some of his salutations, if you look at Romans, he takes the part where he says who it's from, and it, you know, it extends for several verses as he fills out his picture of what the gospel is all about. I'm Paul, who was chosen to teach the gospel, and here let me tell you what I think that is. So it's more than just this is from Paul. He's actually using it to paint a picture. This salutation in this letter is one of the shorter ones, but still, I think the idea, there are ideas in it that are worth talking about. But first of all, we want to talk about, we look at the very first word, it says it's from Paul. I want to stop and give a little bit of background, talk about where in the scheme of things for Paul this letter comes in. So you understand, today we're just kind of getting started, and we're going to talk about background stuff, and the talk that's going to bless your life and change your life forever, that's next week. This is the one that prepares the ground for that. So those who weren't here are just going to have to do with that. Okay, so this is a letter from Paul. Maybe I can say just real briefly as we're starting out that there are those who have challenged the fact that this letter is from Paul. But I don't know if you've ever thought about it, but it's very strange the methodology that scholars use to decide these sorts of things. I mean, they sort of come up to a letter like the letter to the Galatians, and they say, okay, we cannot find any reason to think that this is not what it says it is, a letter from Paul. If there's any letter that's from Paul, that letter to the Galatians is from Paul. So then they'll look at something like Colossians and say, well, he uses words in here that he doesn't use in Galatians. And he, the way he talks about things, it's framed a little differently than he does over here. So this must not be from Paul because he uses different language. And then they'll also say, this has sections that are just like what's in Ephesians. So this must not be from Paul either. So it's not from Paul because it's too much like his writing and it's not enough like his writing, is their argument essentially. And I think all we have to do is stop. These kinds of arguments, I feel like I've had the advantage of, for 20 years, I've been working in ministry teaching with a group of other people. I've been talking, I've been writing, I've been listening to other people talk, I've been reading what they write, and I think about the kinds of arguments that people use about how this isn't Paul, and I apply them to my own talking and writing and the way I've heard people talk and write over the past 20 years, and I think we could prove that a lot of us here didn't say what we said using a methodology like this, because this sort of thing happens. I will take ideas that I've talked about one way over here, and I'll put a little spin on it and come at it a little differently the next time I talk about it. Or else, it may be that I've just recently in my thinking developed a way of thinking about things, and each time I talk about this topic, I kind of lay out the same structure, so you'd see a very close similarity in the way I've done things, because that's the way I'm thinking about it at this particular moment in time. As we're going to see, the book of Ephesians and the book of Colossians were probably written at the same time. So, is it surprising that there are a lot of features that are in common between them? No, I think that makes a lot of sense. So, I just want to sort of forearm you a little bit here against, I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but you go and you read a commentary or you look at that scholarly stuff out there and you hear people saying, well, this probably isn't written by Paul. And all of a sudden you feel on the defensive, like, if I try to believe that it is by Paul, I'm being obscurantist. I'm not being objective. I'm not considering the evidence like these scholars out there. I just want to kind of encourage you to stop and think that there's an awful lot of scholarship that, however much it may be involved in serious looking at the evidence and so on, is fatally flawed by a profound lack of common sense as to how people talk to each other and write to each other. It's just true. I mean, and we could go and look, and I think I could make really strong arguments if we wanted to go and look at all of that as to why that stuff is just nonsense. So I guess I'm encouraging you to not be intimidated by that kind of stuff. I'm not getting down on scholarship, you understand. I would like to hope that every now and again what I do rises to the level of scholarship. It's not that it's a bad thing, but it needs to be, it's done out of a view of the world. We make these decisions out of what makes sense to us. And a lot of scholarship is done by people that know an awful lot about history and culture and so on of the ancient world, but have a screwy way of looking at life that colors the conclusions that they draw. And you just need to be aware of that. So, this letter claims to be by Paul. I see absolutely no reason to think that it is not by Paul. When you look at all of the evidence and the interlocking relationship between several letters here, it fits in very well. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about Paul's circumstances. I'm going to try to use this map and see. I don't know if you can see this, but we'll try. Are we? I think so. You may recall that Paul was converted on the Damascus Road. He was an opponent of Christianity, and Jesus appeared to him and called him to be an apostle. And Paul spent a number of years sort of out of the limelight, away from everybody, during a time where I think where he was being taught by God, where Jesus appeared to him and taught him the things that he was to go on and teach. That's what he claims in his letters, that Jesus himself taught him the things that he knew. At a certain point, I think, and let me make the apology here. I'm going to give you some dates as we go along, just to give you some perspective as to how this stuff works. But all of these dates are debatable within a year or two. I mean, you will hear people arguing, no, it ought to be here. I picked a set of dates to give you some perspective, but they could vary back and forth a little bit. And there are controversial things in what I'm going to say here, and I'm not even going to bother to point them out or defend them or anything. I'm just trying to sort of give you a feel for it. Paul has been converted, has been away from the limelight for some time, and you may recall that Barnabas goes and gets him and brings him to Antioch over here, which is where kind of one of the first congregations of Gentile believers is growing up. And Acts says that the believers, isn't it in Antioch that they were first called Christians? Isn't that what it says? Okay, so Barnabas is there in Antioch, and he goes and gets Paul, and so Paul kind of establishes a base of operations with Barnabas there in Antioch. Paul goes on what we now refer to as his first missionary journey, which is, if his conversion was somewhere around 34 AD, say, then the first missionary journey would be from 46 to 48. And that's this yellow part here. I don't know if you can see it. Basically, it's in this small area. Paul comes down here to Cyprus, comes up into these churches, these towns up in this area. And although this is a controversial statement, my understanding is this is the area that he writes to when he writes the book of Galatians. This is where that group is. So he comes down here, comes up, comes back around, and goes back to Antioch. That was the first missionary journey. It took him a couple years. When he gets back, there is this growing controversy about what he has been saying to the Gentiles, about whether they need to become Jews or not. And there have been groups that have been going around to some of the towns where Paul taught, and essentially saying to the Gentiles there, okay, great, you guys, you believe that Jesus is the Messiah. Now let's finish the job so you can get saved like me and become a Jew like me. This is the Judaizers who went out and did that. It's in response to that that Paul writes his letter to the Galatians. And so from my perspective, although there are debates about this, Galatians is an early letter, the first letter of Paul's that we have. written in response to the problems that showed up in these towns where he had evangelized and formed churches. Finally, the pressure gets so great that he and several others travel down to Jerusalem after the book of Galatians has been written, as I understand it, to have a council with the apostles there to talk about this issue. Is Paul right in what he is saying to the Gentiles? And the conclusion of the council is, yes, he is right about that. We're all in agreement on that. And so Paul goes back up to Antioch. So that's all. Those are the events that I think of as concerning the first missionary journey, which culminates in the book written, the letter written to the Galatians, and the council where these issues are sorted out. Okay? Having gone through all that then, Paul, with this renewed confidence that indeed, you know, we're together on this stuff, goes off on his second missionary journey, which would be around from 49 to 52 AD. The second missionary journey on this map is in red. Now, I don't know if you can see what's going on here. Along here, down here is where Israel, Judea of the time would have been. Here's Jerusalem. Antioch is up here. This is Asia Minor, what we think of as Turkey now. The town of Ephesus is here. The town of Colossae, where this letter that we are going to be looking at is inland from Ephesus. We come along up into Macedonia over here. We have Philippi, Thessalonica, and we come down into Greece where we have the city of Corinth. And then further over we have the boot of Italy and Rome up here. Okay, so that's what we're looking at. On his second missionary journey, Paul takes off from Antioch, comes along working his way through Asia, and at a certain point, you may remember, he has a vision calling him to Macedonia. It's kind of, it's a turning point. Paul moving out, you know, across this body of water into Macedonia and Greece, sort of new territory. He goes to Philippi. He goes to Thessalonica. He has a lot of trouble there. He comes down to Corinth, establishes a church there in Corinth, stays there for like a year and a half, I think. And while he is in Corinth, he writes two letters back to the church that he had founded in Thessalonica. So he was coming around here, founded a church in Thessalonica, and the two letters to the Thessalonians that we have were written from Corinth on the second missionary journey, kind of back. He had been there, and now, who knows exactly what the time frame is, but if he was here a year and a half, it could be like, you know, a year after he founded that church or something like that, he's writing to the Thessalonians. Okay. He finally leaves Corinth, goes across to Ephesus, back down to Jerusalem, and up to Antioch again. So there's the loop that ends the second missionary journey. Okay. So after the first missionary journey, he wrote Galatians to this group. After the second missionary journey, he wrote the two Thessalonians, or during the second missionary journey, he wrote the two letters to the Thessalonians. Okay, now we come to the third missionary journey of Paul. He goes out again. And this is the most complex of his journeys. This is the one that yields us several substantial letters that we need to deal with. He takes off from Antioch again. We're looking at the green this time. And he comes over to Ephesus. While he's there, this is the third missionary journey, is from 53 to 57, probably somewhere in there. While he's in Ephesus, he's in contact with and knows about problems that are going on in the church in Corinth across over here. Remember, he was there for a year and a half. He knows those people pretty well. He writes 1 Corinthians to them while he's there in Ephesus. Having written 1 Corinthians, he leaves Ephesus, coming around this way, planning to go around here and visit Corinth. He had originally just planned to cross over and hit Corinth initially, but he's worried because he's hearing these problems that are going on in Corinth. So he decides, he knows that Titus, I think it was, is coming around this way. So Paul decides that he wants to come around this way and meet Titus and find out what the heck is going on with the Corinthians. So he does. He meets him somewhere in Macedonia, I think. And having heard from Titus that there are some good things going on in Corinth, that some of the people there have really responded to Paul's first letter and so on, he is happy about that and writes what we know as 2 Corinthians to the Corinthian church. Then he moves along, ends up in Corinth again, and I know Jack thinks differently, but I'm still convinced at this point that it's when he arrives in Corinth on the third missionary journey that he writes the book of Romans from there. I think last time I heard Jack thinks that he wrote it from Jerusalem after the end of this journey, but probably not that big a deal. But he comes to Corinth, I think he writes the book of Romans from there, where he tells the Romans he would really like to get there, and he doesn't know if and when that's going to be possible, but he's really praying that it would be possible. He goes back around, takes this route again, goes down to Jerusalem. The end of the third missionary journey is in Jerusalem. He doesn't make it back to Antioch again, because you may recall that is where he is arrested and end up being taken to Rome as a prisoner to appeal to Caesar. That part of his life seems to be from 57 to 63 AD, quite a chunk of years. He arrives in Rome, and most people think that it is while he is in Rome, waiting for his appeal before Caesar, that he writes most of what we think of as his imprisonment letters. Okay? He writes, he's in Rome, and there is a guy named, well, I'll tell you about that in a second. My understanding is that while he's in Rome, he writes a letter, he writes three letters to this area here. One of them is the letter to the Ephesians, one of them is the letter to the Colossians, and one of them is the letter to Philemon, who lives in Colossae. You know the letter of Philemon? He writes to Philemon, Onesimus, his slave, had become a Christian and was with Paul, serving Paul. Paul's sending him back to Philemon, and he's basically asking him to accept him, to forgive him, you know, for having left. He had escaped before and taken off. So Philemon lives in Colossae. So Paul writes those letters. Towards the end of his imprisonment, he writes a letter to Philippi, the letter to the Philippians. And then, as best we understand it, he gets off. He is released from prison. He goes on to travel around for several more years. While he's traveling from 63 to 66, he writes, probably from the Macedonia area, he writes to Timothy and Titus in their respective churches where they're teaching at the time. And finally, he is arrested again, awaiting execution, probably in Rome. And although we don't have an account of this in Acts, but tradition tells us that Paul was arrested again in Rome and was executed. And he writes the last letter, what we know as 2 Timothy, writing to Timothy saying he expects to die soon. Okay. Now, I wanted to kind of give you this background so that you can see. In particular, now, we want to focus in on this time in Paul after he's been on the three missionary journeys. He is imprisoned in Rome, and he writes these letters to Ephesus, Colossae, and to Philemon, who is living in Colossae. That's what we want to talk about for a minute. Okay, it seems pretty clear that Paul did not found this church. This is not, in Colossae, this is not a church that Paul founded. Colossians 1:4, he says, "Since we heard of your faith in Christ Jesus and the love which you have for all the saints," seeming to imply that this is something that has been reported to him. In Colossians 2, he says, "I want you to know how great a struggle I have on your behalf and for those who are at Laodicea and for all those who have not personally seen my face," perhaps implying that the Colossians are among those who have not met him, although it's not certain that this is the case. It does seem to sound as if, however, that it is Epaphras who evangelized the Colossians first. Paul says, he talks about, "just as you learned the gospel from Epaphras, our beloved fellow bondservant, who is a faithful servant of Christ on our behalf." Sounds very much like he's saying that Epaphras was the one who preached the gospel to them. And Epaphras seems to be with Paul right now in Rome as this letter is being written. At the end, he sends greetings from Epaphras. Okay, now, again, as part of the background, we need to get this picture. There is a guy named Tychicus who is going to Asia. He's in Rome with Paul on his way to that area. Okay, so he is in Rome, and he is heading towards Ephesus and Colossae in that area. In Colossians, Paul says, "As to all my affairs, Tychicus, our beloved brother and faithful servant and fellow bondservant in the Lord, will bring you information. For I have sent him to you for this very purpose, that you may know about our circumstances and that he may encourage your hearts." So this letter to the Colossians is being carried by Tychicus, who also there can answer all their questions about, you know, what's going on, what's happening with Paul, he's in prison, is he okay, is he going to get out, you know, all of that kind of stuff. Tychicus is also reported as being the one who carries the letter to the Ephesians. And if you look at the map, you can see that makes sense. Paul's in Rome, he's sending an emissary of sorts to that area. Ephesus and Colossae are not that far apart compared to the distance from Rome to that area. So in Ephesians, Paul says a similar thing. He says, "that you also may know about my circumstances, how I am doing. Tychicus, the beloved brother and faithful minister in the Lord, will make everything known to you, and I have sent him to you for this very purpose, that so that you may know about us and that he may comfort your hearts." So again, Tychicus is carrying the letter that we think of as the letter to the Ephesians, and he's carrying this letter to the Colossians. Now, in Colossians, Paul says, "with Tychicus, I am sending Onesimus," or however you pronounce it, "our faithful and beloved brother." That's the slave of Philemon. So are you with me here? The letter to the Colossians is being carried by Tychicus, and going with him is Onesimus, who is the slave of Philemon. He escaped, he became a Christian, and is serving Paul in his imprisonment in Rome. In Philemon, Paul says, "I'm sending him back to you, because I didn't want to presume," he says. "He's of great comfort to me, but I didn't want to presume. I know he's your slave. I know he escaped from you. So I'm sending him back for you to do what you will." But he very strongly hints, "let him go and send him back to me." But he kind of leaves that to Philemon to decide what he's going to do. Okay. And then in Philemon, we see Onesimus is being sent back to him. So you see how the picture works here. Ephesians is being carried by Tychicus. Colossians is being carried by Tychicus. And there, they're told that Onesimus is coming with him. Why did he say that in Colossians and not Ephesians? Because Onesimus is from Colossae. That's where he's from. So they know him there. And then in Philemon, Paul says, "I'm sending Onesimus to you." So this is why we have the picture that all of these three letters essentially were sent at the same time on this same trip that Tychicus makes on behalf of Paul. Okay, so does that make sense? Are you getting the picture here? I hope I'm not being too convoluted. These letters are Paul's prison letters. All three of them are written at a time when he's in prison, and then a little later he writes to the Philippians. So those four letters all seem to be from the same imprisonment, probably from Rome, although there's some debate about that too. So it's after all of Paul's missionary journeys, he's in prison, and he writes these letters. And as he's writing at this time, in Philemon he says, and in the Philippian letter he says as well, he expects to be released. And tradition tells us that he was released. And drawing deductions from the various letters we have, it seems to be the case that he was released. 2 Timothy, he's in prison again. But that imprisonment letter, he's saying, I expect to die. So in his own expectations, you can see the difference between them. The first imprisonment letters, he expects to be released. In the second imprisonment letter, he expects to die. And in each case, he was right. He seemed, if we're understanding the circumstances, he was released from the first one. He was not from the second one. Okay, so those are the circumstances of Paul. That's where the book of Colossians fits into things in Paul's life. Paul goes on to introduce himself to them as an apostle of Jesus Christ. You're probably familiar with this language by this time. Apostle, the word talks about one who has been sent out as an authorized representative. And it is derived from, in the culture, just look at this map. As the crow flies, if you went from Jerusalem to Corinth, it'd be about like 800 miles or something like that. And they didn't have airplanes or cars or things like that. So for a king to have rule over a large area, he can't be everywhere at once. He sends people out as his representatives. They take his messages to the people. When the representatives get there, if there are problems, the representative rules on those problems for the king. He knows he's going to have to give an account to the king ultimately for what he did. And he has been trusted by the king to do what the king would do if he were there. That's what an apostle was. I mean, culturally speaking, an apostle was a representative of a king sent out to bring his message and decide things according to his will. And I think that's very representative of what the word means in the New Testament. The apostles saw themselves as having been called to be authorized representatives of Jesus. Jesus has the authority. Jesus is the Messiah. Jesus is the King. But his apostles are the ones sent out to bring his message and to give rulings that are in keeping with his principles and mindset and so on. So to claim to be an apostle of Jesus Christ, as I understand it, is to make a claim for great authority. Paul is saying, I have been called to be the authorized representative of Jesus. He is not going to speak to you anymore. You're not going to sit around listening to him give the Sermon on the Mount. He's gone in that sense, but I am not gone. I'm here, and I'm here to speak for him. And to further emphasize that, he says, by the will of God, which is something, this is an idea that Paul talks about a lot. He often emphasizes his assertion that God is the one who decided that Paul would be an apostle. If you kind of picture the alternatives, I think, as I look at my life, I could say that in the circumstances of my life, God has called me to do what I do. But I could not say, by the will of God, I am a teacher here in this church, the way Paul is saying it. Because what he's saying is, this was a decision. This was not my decision. I didn't look at all the evidence and decide, well, maybe I should be an apostle. This was God coming to him and saying, you're going to be an apostle. This is my decision. You, not this guy. You know, this guy, he's smart and he has a lot to say and he's going to have a great ministry. But Paul, you are going to be an authorized representative for me. This idea, you know, not by the will of man. The other apostles didn't appoint me as an apostle. I didn't appoint myself as an apostle. I didn't sit around, come up with some great ideas and think, I need to get out there and spread these around. God grabbed a hold of me as I was busy murdering Christians. He grabbed a hold of me and said, you are going to be my representative. Not the only one, but one of them. He also mentions Timothy in this letter. I never pay much attention to that. I don't know if I'm being amiss, but I never see any evidence in any of these letters that really any of it is Timothy's writing. I mean, it says this is from Paul and Timothy, and then Paul immediately will start talking about himself personally in, you know, in letters. So the Timothy part, I think he means Timothy is here with me. But he's not claiming that Timothy is writing the letter with him, I don't think. Okay, so that's who it's from. Paul the Apostle and Timothy with him to the saints and faithful brethren in Christ. I don't know how it happened in the history of the church that the word saint came to be applied to. Like, I just saw a letter, an article. Didn't the Pope recently declare some more saints here recently, I think? But that idea that sainthood is this thing you sort of arrive at, having attesting miracles and all of that sort of thing, I don't know how the word came to be attached to that. In the New Testament, the word saint, holy one, is Paul's way of referring to believers. Believers are holy ones. If you are a believer, if you belong to God, if your destiny is to inherit the kingdom of God, then you are a saint. Here's what I understand this to mean. First of all, you understand it's the word holy. You are holy ones, is what he's saying. This is the word that's related. We get holy, hallowed, sanctified, sanctification. I mean, all of these words are related to this Greek word that Paul uses here. Its primary meaning, as I understand it, emphasizes the difference between the sacred and the profane. And the example that always, the thing that I think about is, take something like the temple, and then you go someplace else in Jerusalem, and there's a big building that somebody has built, and it's real exotic and fancy. You look at the temple, and you look at this other building, and maybe this, I mean, I don't think there was a building like this, but there could have been a building that was just as fancy and ornate as the temple. But the temple is holy, and this other building is not. It's just common, mundane, profane. Because this temple belongs to God and is dedicated to the things of God. So it may look the same, but if it belongs to God, then it is unique. Most boxes, you can carry them all you want. You touch the Ark of the Covenant and you die because it's holy. It's set apart. It belongs to God. It is not just your everyday, ordinary box. So the primary meaning of holy has to do with this. It belongs to God. It is unique. There's an aura of it is awe-inspiring because the creator of the universe has claimed this as his own. This is something you don't mess with. This is, whoa, look out, because this is holy. I think that's the primary thing that Paul is communicating when he refers to us as holy ones. That we belong to God. That in the world is filled with people who are children of the devil, children of darkness, people who are set against God, people under the wrath of God whose destiny is eternal condemnation. And then among them, there are these people on whom God has placed his hand, He has come along and said, you are mine. Those are holy ones. They belong to God. They're distinctive and unique, the way the temple is a different sort of building than the Empire State Building. The Empire State Building may be bigger and really impressive to look at, but the temple belongs to God. Well, there may be people in the world that are more impressive to look at than we are, but we belong to God. We're holy ones. And there's something awe-inspiring if you stop to think about it. Here are people who belong to the Creator of the universe. He has his hand on them. He is using them for his purposes. As Peter talks about, we're being built up into this temple for God. It's like we are this unique part of God's creation and purpose. That's what Paul's getting at. Secondarily, there is the idea that something that is holy, you know, a temple may not have a moral element to it. It's a building. But many of the things that are holy, if they belong to God, they have the capability of having a moral quality to them. And things that have a moral quality and are holy, that moral quality is going to be goodness. Do you see what I'm saying? The word holy does not primarily mean good. It means sacred, belonging to God, awe-inspiringly unique. But things that are holy, like people, a person who is holy, who is awe-inspiringly different, belonging to God, is going to have the mark of God on them, and there is going to be a moral difference. There is something, the Bible talks about our being sanctified, our being holified, made holy. Made more and more like people who belong to God. Not just people that God has chosen to be his own, but people that look like people who belong to God. So, to call us saints, then, I think is to say, these are the ones who belong to God and whose lives are being transformed such that you can see over time that they belong to God. Now, obviously, he used one word here. Where do we get all that stuff? We have to bring in looking at the theology of the rest of Paul's letters about what he says about sanctification and justification and all of that. But I would argue that essentially that's the picture that Paul has in his mind. He calls us saints not because we are morally perfect or because we have attained to some special level that normal believers don't, but he's saying, in this world, there are those that belong to God and those that don't. And I'm writing to the ones that belong to God, and that you can see that they belong to God by the mark on his life, on their life. He refers to them as the faithful brethren in Christ. The word faithful here could mean believing, and that would be possible, but I'm inclined to think that Paul does use this word to mean more like what we mean by faithful. When he speaks about faithful brethren, I think he's implying these are people who have not faithlessly listened to the gospel and then walked away from it, but they have been faithful in hearing it, embracing it, believing it, clinging to it, embracing the implications of it. They have not walked away, but they have faithfully held to the gospel. So it's saying more than just that they believe, but that they have been faithful in believing, I think, is what he's getting at. That's the group that he's writing to. Those who belong to God and who are faithful in their clinging to the gospel. And these are the saints and faithful brethren who are in Colossae. I showed you where Colossae is here. It's kind of a cosmopolitan place, as I understand it. It had Asian influences, obviously, in the area. Greek colonists came over, and there's a lot of Greek influence in the area. There are a lot of Jews living in the town of Colossae, as best we understand. So there are a whole variety of influences in the town. We will not talk about it today, because, and actually I'm not even prepared to talk about it today, but it is common to refer to the Colossian heresy. That is, something in Colossae is going on. There's a problem. Some of Paul's letters are problem letters, and some of them are just more general kinds of letters. This is a problem letter. There is a problem in Colossae. There is a false kind of teaching, a strange sort of view of things that some are embracing. We're going to have to sort of deduce bit by bit as we go along what is the nature of this problem. But all I'll say now is what you do need to understand about Colossians is that there is a problem, and this letter is written to address it. And of course, I hope you're aware, it may not be that we have the problem that they have, but that doesn't mean that this letter is not going to be relevant to us, because the fact is that the problems, the unique problems that the churches have at the time, inspire Paul to write about the truth, theological truths that they need to embrace, and those truths are applicable to a lot of different problems. We may not even be able to exactly decide what the problem is. We may have to say it's something like that. But Paul's answer is going to speak to a lot of issues that we have. So the effort to try to figure out what he's saying to their problem is very much worth making. And then he says, "Greetings, hi, grace to you and peace from God our Father." Grace, again, some people think there's a related word that essentially means greetings that Greeks would have used in this spot. And some think that Paul has deliberately taken that word and changed it to the word grace to be, you know, to say something more profound. Maybe he did. I don't know. I would just warn us against thinking that this is formulaic or mechanical. It is formulaic in the sense that this is what he says pretty much in all his letters. But I think it means more than just sincerely, like in our letters. I think he has chosen to say, this is my desire for you is this. My desire is that God would be gracious to you, would show mercy toward you, and that you would have peace, which could mean a couple of things. Sometimes Paul talks about peace in terms of us being at peace with God. You know, I have been under the wrath of God. There has been a war on between God and myself, with me doing all the fighting and all of the losing at the same time. That war is over. As a believer, I am at peace with God, and thus I have entered the door into the possibility of all his blessings, because I am not under his wrath anymore. That may be what Paul means. Grace and peace with God. May God be gracious to you and be at peace with you, may be what he means. But there is the Hebrew word shalom, which gets translated over into this word in Greek that we're translating as peace, that seems to have the idea of blessing, fullness, the righting of life circumstances. To arrive at peace means the disruption is over, the tragedy is over, you have arrived at peace, at fullness, at blessing, that sort of thing. And that may be more likely what Paul means here. And of course, I mean, all of that is true. He wants them to be at peace with God, to be justified before him. And the whole purpose of that, ultimately, is that God would bless them, that being at peace with him, that they would arrive at peace, that they would arrive at shalom. So, ultimately, of course, Paul wants all of that stuff. Okay, so let me now paraphrase what I think Paul is saying in his salutation here. This letter is from Paul, whom God himself decided to appoint as an authorized representative of Jesus, the Messiah. And Timothy is with me as well. I am writing to the believers who live in Colossae, those whom God has called out of this world to be forgiven, to belong uniquely to himself, and to show his distinctive mark on their lives. those who have shown that they belong among the brotherhood of believers by their faithful adherence to the gospel. My wish for you is that you would arrive at life and blessing through the mercy of God. That's essentially what I think Paul has said in his little salutation. Now, if you'll forgive me for rambling on, I want to just say a few words about that. Some implications of what Paul has said there. I know it's just a salutation, and if all we ever saw of Paul's writing were these salutations, we wouldn't necessarily have any reason to think that he was a profound thinker about these things. But since we do have the rest of his letters to inform us how he thinks about things, I think we can see that he really has some profound ideas in his mind as he's starting to write to them. First of all, he's confronting them with the issue of his authority. I am chosen by God to be an authorized representative. And I think that that's an issue that we constantly face. I think about this a lot. Why are we bothering to go word by word through a letter written by a guy approximately 2,000 years ago? Why are we doing that? Why are we getting together? It's the 4th of July. Why not get started partying earlier, like some of the rest of us did? Why are you coming here? Why are you coming here to talk about this letter by this guy written a long time ago to people who have been dead for a long time? It's because Jesus has claimed to be the Messiah, and we believe him, and Jesus has appointed people to be his representatives, and Paul is one of those people, and Paul is making that claim to the Colossians. I am writing to you as one who has been chosen by God to represent the King of the world to you. That's why we're reading this letter. I believe him. I think he's right. You could decide he's wrong. He's making a claim that is not true. He's a megalomaniac. He's insane. He has delusions of grandeur. And we should just not pay attention to him. But you have to make that choice. What I've never understood is the sort of middle-of-the-road position that great portions of, quote, Christendom take out there, that sort of accept that Paul has a place in their religious lives, but they treat him as if they can feel free to disagree with him about just about anything at all. I can see deciding he's a fraud, and I can see deciding that he is not a fraud, but I can't see treating him as if he were a fraud and saying that he's the real thing. I mean, that doesn't make any sense to me. Why do that? I think it's just better. Just label it as unbelief. I don't buy it. If you don't buy it, okay, at least you know where you stand. Paul was calling them to accept his unique role in the world, and I think he's calling us to accept that thing as well. Secondly, when he talks about his picture of them, Paul is speaking out of this two-part picture of the world that I think is important for us to confront. When he says, I'm writing to the saints, the faithful brethren, Paul thinks there are saints and then there are those who aren't the saints. There are those in this world on whom God has put his hand, and then there are the rest. And what is it that marks the difference between them? On my side of things, it's facing the question, will I believe this or not? Will I embrace this as the truth and live my life in the light of that truth? It's the faithful brethren who are the saints. It makes all the difference in the world. Paul doesn't care. I mean, think about all the different groups he could be writing to. Think about right now, throughout the world, there are people who are writing letters targeting various groups. We want to sell a certain product, and we need to target this group. We need to find out who are the people who like this stuff and send letters to them because they're the ones who will buy our product. There are all kinds of ways of dividing the world up in terms of what you value, what you think is important. Paul divides the world up into those who are the faithful brethren, who are holy ones, who belong to God, and those who don't. That's the crucial distinction. And that's the distinction that we face. I would argue that no other category is ultimately important. We might be really interested in the issue of whether we're rich or poor. We might be very interested in the issue of whether we're popular or not popular. We might be affected by the fact that in my culture, I'm black and the power seems to be with people who are white. That distinction, the underprivileged and the privileged, seems to be an important distinction for many. And while those are realities that we have to face, they're not distinctions that are ultimately determinative of the blessing in my life. I can be poor, I can be unpopular, I can be in the underprivileged class, I can be in every category in this world that you don't want to be in, but if I'm in the category of saint, then I am a winner. I am blessed, I am fortunate above all people. That's the way Paul looks at things. That's why he divides things that way. I'm writing to the ones who are saints, because that's the important distinction. And then finally, what is it that Paul wishes for them? Here he is. Why not say, boy, I hope you get everything you want. Or, if I'm going to wish good things for you, why not wish that you get a lot of money? Or why not wish, there's lots of things that I could wish for you. But Paul sees himself, what's the most profoundly, I'm sort of placing this benediction on you. Here is my desire for you. Have a nice day. No, he doesn't do that. Grace and peace to you from God our Father. That's what I want. I want God to give you life, to bring you to peace graciously, mercifully. I want him to be merciful to you, which is what he's going to have to do if you're going to arrive at peace. That's what I want for you. And even in just a simple thing like the salutation, we can see Paul has a certain set of values that are driving what he's saying. And the question is, are those values mine? If I could pronounce the benediction on my own life, would I pronounce that one? Is grace and peace from God our Father what I want? Okay, well, so two verses into Colossians. Next time we will go farther. I think we have a couple of minutes, perhaps. I kind of rattled on, but we could take a couple of minutes if you have any comments or questions. You may not. We haven't gone very far, but if anybody wanted to tell me how pretty my map was, that would be okay.
You were briefly... you briefly mentioned that you were about how the contemporary church takes the letters of Paul. And you were saying that call him a hoax or believe him, but you weren't. Could you give an example of what you mean by that or how you see that? I was just curious what you were specifically looking at when you...
Well, there are a lot of different things I could be thinking about there. There is that part of what we might call the mainstream church in the classic sort of liberal conservative distinction is kind of the liberal side of things, where you will find people who essentially their Christianity, as far as I can tell, is a defining feature of their cultural life. You know, I go to church on Easter, and I go to church on Christmas, and maybe I go to church every week, but I don't go there out of the sense that Paul is... I want to read Paul's letters because he has a message that has been entrusted him from God that I need to conform my life to. It's more this attitude, I go there because I know that the Bible is about love and tolerance, and I'm into love and tolerance, and so we'll kind of pick out verses that, you know, my favorite verses from Paul are 1 Corinthians 13, you know, love is patient and kind, and that kind of stuff, and Galatians 2, or is it 3? Right at the end of 2 and 3 there. I think it's 2. You know, in Christ there is neither male nor female, you know, slave or free, you know, that sort of thing. It's those liberating, empowering, that's what I'm into, and we'll get together and talk about that kind of stuff. But, I mean, obviously Paul had an antiquated view of sexual morality. I mean, and he was very judgmental about homosexuals, and he didn't understand the relationship between men and women, and even, you know, even to the point of, you know, he expected Jesus to come back, and obviously that didn't happen, and, you know, that's a nice symbolic idea that Jesus is going to come back and fix everything, but really, you know, your life is in this world and you need to make it work here. Do you see what I'm saying? There, I don't want to characterize unfairly, but I see a whole stream of Christianity that likes the ethics of Christianity and the cultural trappings of Christianity, but they would look at Paul saying, if Jesus wasn't raised, your faith is in vain. And they look at that and say, I don't even understand what he's talking about. I mean, what, you know, he gets kind of wild sometimes saying stuff like that, because of course it's just the concept of resurrection that is so inspiring to us. I'm not saying, you know, the fact that Jesus rose from the dead and is going to come and judge my life and send me to hell. No, that's, you know, that all of that is, that's superstition, we know, but there's still many beautiful truths in the Bible. You know, I love Psalm, 32 or Psalm 21 or, you know, whatever, 20, what's the, 23, is that the one I'm thinking of? Yeah. Not 32, 23. That's one of the kinds of things that I'm talking about, is I have never been able to understand that. Is why in the world would you want to embrace the culture of Christianity and leave out the ideas? I'm having a problem. I've embraced the ideas of Christianity. I'm still having a problem embracing the culture. So to actually take the step that I don't think it's true, but I'm going to live in this world, I guess my feeling is, if I decided it wasn't true, I'd be out of here like a shot. why do this Christianity stuff if it's not true? Does that make sense?
Do you also see it in like more mainstream? I'm thinking I'm seeing a similar version more and more, where it's all about, well, it's usually called application. It's right. Not, let's not study and find out what Paul meant. Right. Let's make it mean what we want it to mean.
Right.
But disregard any historical validity or right. Contextual value.
Right.
It seems somewhat similar.
That I see what you're saying, and that I was thinking of that as well when I said that there are different things that would come under this category. That's another one. We could look at evangelicals, people who would, in theory, you know, they're going to argue, oh no, you know, Jesus really was born of a virgin, and Jesus really rose from the dead, and the Bible is inerrant, and it's our authority. I mean, they argue for the right kind of stuff, but in practice, they do not treat the Bible as this source of understanding about life that has something specific to say that I need to get in, first of all, and make sure I understand what it's saying, and then reform and change my way of life and the way I think about things in conformity with that view. Yeah, there's a lot of the evangelical world that, in essence, pays lip service to the authority of the Bible and the authority of Paul, but in practice denies that authority by essentially not paying any attention to him, by just treating him as, you know, I kind of skim through it and so now here's what it means to me. And Paul never had the chance to authoritatively affect the way I live my life because I wasn't paying any attention. You know, it's like, you know, if he had walked into the room and he was standing here talking, and while he's talking, I'm interrupting him and saying, oh, yeah, that's really good, and, you know, and then start off on something that I think is vaguely related to what he's talking about, but I'm not even sure what the topic is. If you saw me doing that here, you would think, how rude, how inexcusably rude he's being to Paul. He obviously doesn't care anything about what he's saying. But in fact, I think some of us do take that attitude when we're looking at the Bible. We keep interrupting him and talking about other things and not actually stopping and listening to what it is that he's saying. Yeah, that's true. I think initially what I had in mind, though, was that first group that I was talking about, that would actually, I think explicitly, they would even understand that they have given Paul a place because he has in their lives because he has to do with Christianity, but they wouldn't go so far as to actually submit to his authority. I mean, obviously he has too many reactionary ideas that need to be amended, but still he did understand a few great things, like, you know, men and women are equal and stuff like that. So I can still let him in the canon.
Great.
Right. And you'll find in those kinds of debates, that's what I'm thinking of as, that's in the mainline, the more liberal part of Christianity. Those debates, some of the people are fairly clear that when they say, you know, we ought to be ordaining non-celibate gay clergy, they know that Paul would be opposed to that. But they think that Paul didn't yet have a fully developed view of you know, all we're meant to be the way they do at this point. So in those situations, there actually is an issue of biblical authority involved. Those who are the conservative groups among them, those who are fighting that within those denominations, are arguing, we can't do this, it's not biblical. This is not what the Bible taught about this stuff. And the answer is, some would try to say, oh yes it is, but many would say, well, but you're being too narrow. You know, the Bible is this guide, but obviously God gave us minds to come to understand things, and we just understand the stuff better that Paul does. So it actually is this strange thing. That's the sort of thing that just totally baffles me. Can't you tell in looking at this that Paul is saying, I'm an authorized representative of Jesus Christ, and you had better pay attention to what I'm saying, because I'm speaking for him? I mean, it's like, no, that's too much. That makes no sense to me. That's part of what I'm saying. I'd rather just say, no, Christianity is not true, than to take that sort of trying to have one foot on the boat and one foot on the dock kind of, you're just going to get wet doing that. Okay, one more, and then we should stop. I have to, oh yeah.
I just have a quick question. Yeah. Was Onesimus, when Paul was hinting that he kind of wanted Onesimus to come back,
right.
I mean, was that basically because they like hit it off and Onesimus was become his good friend, etc.? He didn't want him as a slave. I mean, that wasn't that wasn't part of the Christian way of doing
things. No.
Yeah.
But in fact, let me just. Philemon is very short here. Philemon 10, I appeal to you for my child whom I have begotten in my imprisonment, Onesimus, who formerly was useless to you, but now is useful both to you and to me. And I have sent him back to you in person, that is, sending my very heart, whom I wished to keep with me, that in your behalf he might minister to me in my imprisonment for the gospel. But without your consent, I did not want to do anything, that your goodness should not be, as it were, by compulsion, but of your own free will. For perhaps he was for this reason parted from you for a while, that you should have him back forever, no longer as a slave, but more than a slave, a beloved brother, especially to me, but how much more to you, both in the flesh and in the Lord. And he goes on to say some other things there, but essentially, he's urging, I think, first of all, he's implying that if Philemon were to do the right thing, that he would let Onesimus go, that he would not be a slave anymore. Which is a fairly radical thing, as I understand it, in the culture. And then secondly, he is really, he's sort of, when he says, you know, perhaps he was parted from you only to be restored to you forever, I mean, he is giving him the freedom to decide that Onesimus is going to stay rather than going back to Paul. But Paul is telling him, you know, here I am in prison, you're not here to help me. Onesimus has been here and has been helping me a great deal. And, you know, this is really tearing me up to send him back, but I am going to send him back. I think, pretty strongly implying, I think, I'm hoping that you'll send him back. He uses this language, though I have enough confidence in Christ to order you to do that which is proper, yet for love's sake I rather appeal to you. He's basically saying, I'm not going to, as an apostle, I'm not going to pull rank and say you have to do this. But instead I'm telling you, here's what he's meant to me, here's what's going on. Now you do what you think is best. Which sounds to me like, if I had gotten this letter, I don't know that the distinction between I'm not ordering you to do this would have meant much. What am I going to say to Paul? Because he does say, and I'm expect to get out, and I want you to prepare a place for me. I'm going to be there soon. What am I going to say to him when he shows up? I decided you didn't need him. I decided I wanted to keep him here. No, I don't think so. Okay, well, let's stop.